Hello, I'm Salman Sheikh. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the director of the Brookings Doha Center. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome you here to what I'm sure you'll agree is a very special event on Iraq. What went wrong? What could go right? Let me add that bit to the title. And I thank you first and foremost for coming a little bit earlier to the advertised time. We're very grateful that you've managed to make it, and I'm sure others will join us as we go along. In particular, we're starting earlier because we're extremely lucky to have the gentleman to my left, His Excellency Nikolai Vladinov, the UN Secretary General, Special Representative for Iraq, and head of the mission of UNAMI in Iraq. Now, Nikolai will have to leave us sometime soon after 6 o'clock to get on a plane. But again, it's wonderful for us, and wonderful timing to have him here at this particular time. He is, of course, as I said, the SRSG for Iraq and head of UNAMI, a mission which has been in operation since 2003. Its mandate was expanded in 2007, which particular mandate focusing on advancing inclusive political dialogue, national reconciliation, assisting in the electoral process, working and planning towards a national consensus, and other such things that such missions do, the protection of human rights and judicial and legal reform. His Excellency Vladinov, of course, served as Bulgaria's foreign minister from 2010 to 2013, after briefly serving as its defense minister the year before. He's also active in supporting transition in the Middle East and North Africa. I remember very fondly how Bulgaria, and the foreign minister in particular, was the first to support even our work on Syria and a more inclusive approach to a political process and a political resolution. And of course, he's worked closely to support a stronger European engagement in the world. Your Excellency Nikolai Vladinov, it's a real pleasure to have you. Thank you very much. My great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ala Maki, the member of the Iraqi Islamic Party that participated actively in the secret opposition against the Ba'athist regime. He currently serves as the head of Tajdeed Political Movement Parliamentary Bloc, which is united with the Al-Araqiyya Alliance headed by His Excellency Iyad Alawi. He is a staunch advocate for education as a critical foundation for social development, and he's been the vice chairman of the Education Committee of the Iraq Council of Representatives since 2010. Prior to that, he was the chairman of the Education Committee from 2006 to 2010. Again, thank you very much for making the trip, and thank you for being here at such a critical time. We very much look forward to hearing from your insights. And certainly not least is Dr. Louis Khatib, who is one of ours. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Doha Center, focusing on the geopolitics and political economy of the GCC and Iraq. He's the founder and director of the Iraq Energy Institute, being Iraqi himself, and serves as a senior advisor to the Federal Parliament of Iraq for energy policy and economic reform. He's, of course, got a long private sector career, which has spanned more than 20 years, and is a frequent commentator on your television screens and print media, especially these days. So, again, Louis, it's great to have you. I will get straight into it, given the shortness of time. Nikolai, if I may, I'll come to you first. Many have said that what has gone wrong in Iraq was that we didn't have a more inclusive Iraqi political process. In fact, it wasn't working. And it wasn't working, certainly, as the United States and the United States signaled its intention to leave Iraq. How do you rate the current efforts and, of course, now the formation of the new Iraqi government?
Well, Salman, thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you very much for your interest in what is happening in Iraq today, as I believe it affects everyone, not just in the region, but beyond. As you said in the beginning, rephrasing your question, what went wrong and what can go right, if I can say that over the last decade, many things in Iraq went wrong, but even more things now need to go right for things to work. And that is a fair way, actually, of starting. We have a new government in Iraq, a government that is includes more or less all of the entire political spectrum that is represented in Parliament. One that includes all the communities that make up Iraq's complicated ethnic and religious structure. But that government is only in its first days. It is inclusive and representative of the political forces in Parliament. It now needs to prove that it is inclusive and representative of the people of Iraq. And that will be a very important challenge, particularly for the first steps of the new government. As we all know, a third of the country is under the control of armed groups, ISIL and their affiliated armed groups. Serious problems have emerged over the last months between Baghdad and Erbil related to budget and oil revenue issues. The country faces substantial financial challenges. The level of trust between the various communities is low. Terrorism has been on the rise over the last few years. So all of these things to be tackled, really the first starting point in that will be the steps that the new government needs to take to show that it is actually reaching out to all communities and is able to solve some of the valid concerns that many of the communities in the country have. Now, on top of that, obviously, an important role must be played by the international community supporting Iraq in dealing with the terrorist threat. However, that support would not be effective without the government and its policies in place. So if I can just leave it at that in the beginning, I'm sure we'll talk more about
it. Sure. I'm going to follow up with you one more question, and then I will go back to the challenges, and particularly the issue of inclusivity in a political process that starts to really have an impact on the ground. But of course, the thing that is on many people's mind today is that in the early hours this morning, President Obama is going to give an address to his own people on a strategy for dealing with ISIL or ISIS or IS or Daesh, whatever we want to call it. And I have a question for you, since you are very much at the coalface in Iraq. How do we deal with ISIL?
Well, first we have to have a strategy. We can't do it without a strategy.
Yeah.
And we can't do it without the full engagement of Iraqi society. So if the government is the first step, the second step is actually to have an inclusive Iraqi-led strategy, which actually is supported by all components of Iraqi society and addresses not just their concerns, but looks at how the communities in the country can feel more represented and included in the decision-making process related to their own security, to the distribution of wealth, to the provision of services, so that those groups that have joined in a temporary alliance, Daesh, ISIL, as you wish to call them, can be peeled away, and support can be built for the legitimate state institutions. Now, that is possible if you have an inclusive security plan, if I can just briefly call it that. But it's not enough. What you need also is really a number of social, economic, and other policies that appeal to the core problems that the different communities have. The UN mission in Iraq has spent a lot of time actually looking into great detail of what are the various demands that throughout the last few years have emerged in Iraq's communities on all sides of the ethnic and religious divide. And it's quite a long list, but it is not an undoable list. Many of these problems are in the what we often refer to as the unfinished constitutional agenda, issues that could have been dealt with over the last decade but hadn't been dealt with. Others are related to service provision. Others are related to justice on all sides, how the judicial system functions, how the police or the armed forces function. So a lot of these things need to be tackled, and they can be tackled together with a security strategy. But the third element in this obviously goes beyond Iraq, because the problem is not just in Iraq, and we need to realize that ISIL is a threat not just to Iraq as a country, but to the region, but beyond the region as well. And that demands stronger cooperation within the region. stronger cooperation between Iraq and its neighbors, but also between the neighbors themselves. And it's quite encouraging that in his speech in Parliament when Prime Minister Abadi was voted in, he made a specific point to focus that one of his first priorities in terms of foreign policy will be to reach out to Iraq's Arab neighbors and to rebuild that relationship. Now, obviously, that will need to take time and it will need to be supported. Of course, none of this can work without the international community having a consistent and coherent strategy on how to deal with Syria, because that's the other side of the equation, if you wish. But on the Iraqi side, I think now we have a little bit more hope than before that things can come together, both on the ground, in the politics of it, in the social and economic part of it, as well as in the international regional cooperation side.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you one more question, just to take full advantage, linked to the international community's role. Of course, the United States and others are now engaged in military intervention in Iraq again. It has the support of the region, it has the support of the Iraqi government. But going forward, and you've laid out a more comprehensive strategy focused on Iraqis themselves, how is it that this military intervention of the United States in Iraq again needs to be calibrated going forward?
Well, I suppose one way of calibrating is to, from the very beginning, admit that this problem cannot be resolved only militarily, that it needs obviously a security component to it, but it also needs a political component to it. And the security component of it needs an Iraqi armed force, Iraqi security forces that are strong, that are well managed, that are also representative of the people, so that the people in the provinces where these forces would need to operate would not feel estranged from them, to say the least. That's an important part of it. Second part is that the cooperation between the government in Baghdad and the Kurdish regional authorities in Erbil needs to be strengthened. And we've seen some good start to that already. And that needs to be further developed. Thirdly, the capacity of Iraq's forces is not just a question of what are the weapons that you have. That's obviously an important part of it. But it goes far beyond that in terms of how the armed forces are structured, how they are motivated, in terms of the ideology, in terms of the belief in their role in protecting their own country, in the inclusivity of all the various components in them. So another encouraging sign over the last few days has been this notion which the new government is putting forward of creating a national guard, a national guard that would in fact mean that the provinces themselves would be able to have more responsibility as per the constitution for their own security. And obviously this is an important part of it. Then there's the international role for it. The international support for this process is very important. NATO has put forward ideas of a training mission to Iraq. The European Union is looking at how to support Iraq as well. But obviously a key component would be the air strikes and intervention from Iraq's allies. Now that in itself needs to be extremely well calibrated so that the targets that are picked are really the targets that are related to the infrastructure that supports the existence of ISIL, their supply routes, their bases, etc., and limits very much the civilian impact of that. However, none of this can work without a truly inclusive political process in place. Otherwise, the problem will perpetuate itself, it's not going to get resolved, and it will breed more anxiety among the people of Iraq. And that is something we need to avoid from the beginning.
Thank you very much. I'm actually going to take up where you left off and to Dr. Ala. Yes. About this inclusive political process. There's been a lot, it's become a mantra now, that there needs to be much more Sunni inclusion, Sunni demands met, but there are also Sunni complexities in dealing with this. How would you rate so far the efforts to bring in the Sunni political classes as well as the Sunni communities on the ground into the political process, and what is it that needs to be done?
Well, thank you for this invitation. I'll try to speak in Arabic with all respect to the audience here, because some 10 to 15 million people now listening to us through Al Jazeera channel in Iraq. They're waiting from the United Nations and from us to give solutions, at least recommendations, to push the track. So, I mean, forgive me to talk in Arabic.
Ala wasan.
Thank you very much. Bismillah ar-Rahman.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful, as you know, that Iraq is part and parcel of the Middle East, and the Middle East witnesses a battle between international powers, and also there are competitions in terms of interests. And what is resulting of these battles is due to this interest problem in the region. What is important for us is Iraq. So Iraq is part of the Middle East, and consequently, the situation is reflected in Iraq due to the problem of interests. And the political situation is not stable since 2003. And this is the reason why this is happening. So this is the reason behind the situation, and this is the title of the discussion that is taking place today. For us to be able to have a step forward, the Iraqi people is very much divided. The agendas are in contradiction. So some of the Iraqi people are trying to implement one agenda, one other part of Iraq is trying to implement another agenda. So there is a kind of a political system that is a failure. I'm going to say it's as such. And please excuse me for being too clear and blunt. Maybe sometimes politics aims not to be too clear, but we are not in a political situation now. 50 or 60% of Iraq is in a very bad situation. People have been forcefully, moved from their areas to other areas. That is why we have to be very frank. And we can also reach a number of, solutions here. So we have to do so. So the different components of Iraq have been in disagreement with each other. When the Americans came, Sunnis were not pleased with that. So their confrontation was very violent. And after that, they understood the situation and they entered the political process late. And their entry into their political process did not lead to a result until today. Until after we have seen today, they have left their own governorates, the houses were demolished, destroyed, women, children were killed before men, and there was a kind of a dislocation of people, and we are in a situation in which Iraq is, it's no longer a homeland. It's no longer a homeland. People say, we do not live in our homeland, we do not live in our, houses. So this is a kind of an uprising in these governorates. So the entry of Sunnis in the political process up to today, in truth, and I'm saying this to the international community directly, Sunnis have not yet really entered into a political process. Those who have entered were not successful in their entry. And they have to be really, really successful and present a successful project and try to save those they represent. People are a little bit optimistic in forming such a government, but what is very important in this government are the two ministries, which are the Interior and the Defense. And up to today, they are still pending. We haven't have a minister up to there. There can be a number of mechanisms, and NATO maybe would be waiting to have a kind of a governmental resolution or decision, but the Iraqi people have gone and they have voted. But the real problem now is the security problem. The provinces, the governorates are occupied by forces from outside Iraq. How can we reach these provinces? So the brothers who are in parliament and represent these provinces, how are they going to communicate with their people? Where are they? How can they communicate with them? So the entry of Sunnis into this political process in an inclusive government, they face a challenge. Yes, we have participated in the government. We were part of the negotiations, and we warned that without solving the security situation or problem, and without the return of the people who have been dislocated now to their places of origin and the marginalization that took place in the last decade, all these things have to be solved. We have to find a solution instantly. I think we have to have a surgical solution. I mean, this is to save Iraq. There is a difference between having a very critical and intricate surgery and trying to maybe find a solution for somebody whose leg is broken. So this is the general impression about the entry of Sunnis into the Iraqi government. As my friend Meldinov has said, he said what is very important is to have a real representation of the people on the ground, because they have to participate in the decision-making process and to decide about their own destiny. This representation has not been clarified yet. And if this is going to happen, and here I'm talking to the international community, if we're going to be late in that process in finding a solution to the problem, as we have done when we formed the government in 2010 and we waited for 4 years, without a minister of defense, I think we're going to face more catastrophes. And I think Sunnis, they consider themselves dead. So, and it is very difficult for them. It would be very easy for them to take a suicide decision since they consider themselves dead. So we need to have clarity. We need to have credibility. We need to have a clear-cut strategy in dealing with this file. We, as Iraqis, as patriots, we always come up with positive proposals. We have participated in the government, and we have also told Mr. Haider, we congratulated him for his position and we wish him success, and we're going to support him in all means and methods that he is going to take for success, but we have to be realistic. Thank you very much.
To follow up on that, and thank you for your frankness, and that is with regards to the Sunni political representation itself. You have Sunni representation in government, in Parliament, and yet there is still a feeling that is this capturing the mainstream Sunni opinion, particularly in the provinces? How does one achieve that now?
In fact, the Sunnis are there, those who are in the Parliament, are there since 2003. In 2003, I was in a political party, by the way. You said that I'm for the Islamic Party. No, I am not in the Islamic Party now. I am now in the Wataniya coalition, and I went at the elections in that capacity. But I, as a Sunni, since 2003, I have been in the political process, and they are there since 2003, all the Sunnis. But there you are. This is the result. The result is that they still are marginalized. This formal or symbolic representation, which does not lead to any action, is something we don't even want to discuss any issue that's not built on action and work would be just something that is superficial. So ask me, how can the Sunnis get into the political process now? In fact, they are prepared now to make an army and to arm themselves and to fight. And many of them, frankly speaking, have joined Daesh because Daesh had killed many Sunnis right in front of their eyes, and this led to their fears. And so they say to themselves that the army collapsed in a few minutes, and the security forces are not there. Daesh is stronger than them all, so why should I not join them? So those who are in principle refused that went and migrated to elsewhere, especially the chiefs of the tribes and the academicians and the intellectual people. All the senior people. But those, the poor people, the helpless people, had to stay and had to accept this new situation that they cannot fight. As for the youth, they have volunteered to join Daesh and they are now receiving monthly salaries, $2,000 a salary, just like the army. And this is something very dangerous. So how can the Sunnis get into the political process we should take all these points into consideration, that the Ministry of Defense should be created and all decisions that were promised should be implemented. It's not useful to raise hands in the parliament to accept a decision so that it becomes an official agenda and the international community just waits for that. No, this is useless because this will lead to even a worse situation. What is required is a real representation, and I see that the representation so far is sort of ambiguous, and people can hear me now, and I've said, I told you, in fact all Iraq is hearing me, all the world is hearing me, but in particularly there are about 10 to 15 million people are listening to me now, and they are waiting for what will be decisions or resolutions taken by UN or by the politicians of the Brookings Centers or from the participants of this event so that we might reach a solution. Shukran.
And we accept. Okay. Let's hear whatever. Whatever, we will be practical.
Let me ask you one final question, yes, before I move on. What is your attitude towards the American military strikes now that are ongoing to push back Daesh?
Well, Said Miladinov.
Mr. Miladinov said something very important. That the most important thing in the fighting Daesh is the air force. I disagree with him. The most important thing in this fight against Daesh is the ground itself, the people themselves. And in fact, in the past period, there was the Al-Qaeda, which is something similar to Daesh one way or the other, and Al-Qaeda had the control almost the same provinces that are under control of Daesh now. And we had said to the American side that there cannot be only airstrikes and air force. No, there must be ground forces also. The people of these provinces accepted and volunteered to fight Al-Qaeda with the support of the Americans. And, you know, we don't want to go into details, but we were very active in this issue. So the Al-Qaeda disappeared. But those who fought Al-Qaeda were killed gradually, one after the other. They were not given salaries, and they found themselves in a very difficult situation. And I have met many of them in the past months. Some of them are the army officers of the old army, and some fighting factions that they call the resistance. We met them as politicians. We in Al-Wataniya bloc, we understood their situation, and we supported Dr. Ayad Allah. We made many statements in this regard, and we did also in a clear way. they are all military people, and they said that we can divide ourselves into divisions in the different provinces, but what we need is support, and we need American understanding of and international community's understanding, the United Nations understanding and support, and then a cooperation with our colleagues or brothers, especially the government of the Kurdistan region. I thank them for that. They were very supportive. And we can create such a forces, and we can get rid of Daesh, just as we did with Al-Qaeda 4 years or 5 years ago. Somebody might say this is not logical or this is not possible in the political situation present, but I say that history leads to geography. I'm speaking of a history, not of very old history, only 4 or 5 years ago, that led to the geography of today. So what I mean is that I'm speaking of practical, realistic things. I'm speaking in this, addressing the decision makers, international decision makers, the decision makers also in Baghdad, and those in the Middle East in general. Because I began by saying that there are different and contradictory agendas. So we don't want to challenge all these agendas, but we want to deal with them, to have understanding with them, to reach some logical solutions that are in the interest of all the region. So we as politicians, I personally, I think that there's no one country in the Middle East, near Iraq or further, that, with whom we did not meet and did not talk. We also went to the European Union more than once, and Washington and New York, and we met people in the United Nations. We went everywhere, and we are still ready now to play the same role to reach a real solution.
The SRSG started off by talking about as well, and in terms of the budget, the oil, the agreements that have to be forged in terms of revenues, in terms of the more broader power-sharing formula. Do you think when you look at, and then of course the pathway to a constitution, or the pathway to a constitution which satisfies everyone, when you look at this government, and it's a government of politicians as opposed to technocrats, how do you see this playing out, especially given the expectations that there are within certain communities that things will change?
Well, thanks, Salman, for having me on this panel. Well, talking about challenges, I would like to highlight the word of inclusiveness, inclusive government. Many people talked about the inclusive government, so whether this government is inclusive enough. In a nutshell, every single administration came post-2003 is inclusive. And any future administration, I will say, if Iraq to stay in one piece as we see it, will continue to be inclusive. The question is how accountable these governments, how accountable these administrations. I've witnessed, from my personal experience, zero accountability. The Kurds took about their ethnicity. The Sunni talks about their Sunni priority, and the Shia talks about their Shia priority. This has created a significant divide to basically talk about ethno-sectarian issues as opposed to national issues. This has eventually, this unfortunately deferred all the priorities, which is how to define a new federal Iraq. There was a constitution, a federal constitution that passed in December 2005. But since the referendum on that constitution, Iraq is still functioning not as a federal state. It's a federal state on paper, but the central state in practice, governed and constrained by the legacy regimes and legacy law. And this is by the dictation of the Constitution, because Article 130 clearly says is that the legacy laws will continue to be effective until a new amendment or new laws to be repealed, repeal the previous ones. So we are thriving on a state pre-2003 with a major shift and change post-2003. And this is where the conflict we have. In parallel to this, we have a social conflict, and this ethno-sectarian issues, which was unfortunately unnecessary, has been created by the governing council and the Paul Bremer administration. One of the fatal mistakes that underpinned this whole mess that we are witnessing today are two things: is the dismantling of the Iraqi army and the de-Ba'athification that really kind of like drove this whole mess and drove this country into significant problems that it's very difficult to challenge. Added to this, Iraq is surrounded by six countries. Each country has a different foreign policy on Iraq. And each country wants to take an advantage out of Iraq. And it is in the middle of a region where looking into a new democracy emerging, while all the regional countries are sheikdom, kingdom, or basically is not as European democracy as we see it, or something like that. And this has created that clash, and everybody is worried about the future of Iraq and how this is going to lead. So what we are seeing is that there's a significant clashes that are yet to be understood and to create that long-lasting resolve. Now, everyone in the world observing Iraq over the past 10, 11 years, waiting, okay, why this democracy is not functioning? Why this country is not practicing properly? And they all forget about one thing, that democracy doesn't happen by a press of a button. What happened in Iraq is a significant shift, significant change from a 50 years of dictatorship followed by half of it was an absolute tyranny and sanctions and war, etc., into a complete democratic system that is a new language but led to an absolute chaos. Now, if I would benchmark this change with any change that happened in the world in any timeline, whether how Europe reached today's democracy or the United States and so on, surely it's not in 10, 11 years. It took them civil wars. It took them many years, hundreds of years. Now, I'm not suggesting that Iraq needs 100 years to reach democracy. No. But surely it's not a 10 years job or 11 years job. Now, in terms of like the reform, what Iraq needs implementing the reform, if we want to develop a federal state, we really need to look into the key legislation that really need to underpin that federal state. And this is to start with Supreme Court, the federal court. We need to have a court. Without a federal court, without an independent judiciary system, that everyone, every single faction in this country, confident to go and call for its rights and to defend its case, it's going to be impossible to move forward. So this has to be an immediate necessity that it should have been done in the first month in January 2006. The other thing is the revenue sharing. Iraq is a rentier state. And to thrive on oil, and it needs to diversify its economy and its income stream. Now, to reach that level of diversity, it really needs to at least to establish a fair share between the various provinces and so on. But this is also linked to the hydrocarbon law and so on. But these laws is not just laws. These are linked to establishing institutions. And these institutions need to be independent and accountable. Now, back to the word accountability. To have this accountability in place, Iraq really need to restore that national identity. Iraqis need to talk Iraqis. The more the Kurds talk about their 17%, the more they will push a province like Basra that produces 90% of Iraq oil to tell the rest of Iraq goodbye. Then they will not be negotiating their rights with Baghdad, but with Basra. The more the Sunni tribes not engaging with the rest of Iraq, or it's going. I mean, I would love to see Iraq as like a southernist traveling to the western part of Iraq and having picnic without having that fear that, okay, my wife will be kidnapped, I will be beheaded, and my children will be sold. The same thing, a Basrawi and somebody from Nasriya should travel to Kurdistan without having a sponsor to sponsor them. For heaven's sake, it's not another country within a country. So it's all about accountability. Once we have an accountability, we have a country, or at least a step forward.
Thank you very much. Nikolai, you have a few minutes, so I'm going to come back to you and actually take up that point of national identity. You were asked earlier in a different meeting about the lament of Iraq becoming a sort of a proportional representative state in terms of between the sects, you know. And here I've been talking a lot myself about Sunnis and with Shias and Kurds. Is there no other way for the de facto that seems the political system, rather like we've seen in Lebanon or perhaps elsewhere, has become more based on those kinds of thinking rather than that broader Iraqi identity, and how do we get to that?
Well, I think the options are still there. You can have a state in which you have the ethnic and religious communities balance each other out in some form of, you know, quarters. All of this. Or you can have a state in which you have a civic concept of nationality, which allows you to be Iraqi and Sunni and Shia and Yazidi and Kurdish and, you know, Christian or whatever. That is obviously the more difficult path. But given Iraq's history, I think there's plenty of reasons to believe why that should be the preferable path for the country.
Exactly.
And one sees today the difficulties in getting to that. Obviously, if you look at the political landscape, the majority of the political parties in parliament today, their constituencies are based on ethnic or religious communities. And as long as this continues, this will keep replicating this process. Yes. So there needs to be efforts need to be made to bridge those differences. And again, one effort, perhaps, is as we talk about the legitimate concerns that the Sunni tribes and communities and provinces in Iraq have, to acknowledge that the Shia provinces of Iraq also have legitimate concerns,
exactly,
as well as the Kurds. And you can't say, well, let's solve one group's problems but not solve the problems of the other groups. It's quite fascinating. Basra, indeed, is the city which produces more than 90% of the oil in Iraq. Yet if you look at some of the UN studies which we've done, the deepest and most difficult pockets of poverty in Iraq are particularly in the south.
Still, until
today.
Yes.
If you look at the indicators of how of the Millennium Development Goals and various other international indicators, the city of Ramadi, before it was taken over by the rebels and ISIL, had better indicators,
yes,
than Basra.
Yes.
So all of these inequalities exist and they need to be addressed. And this is when I said in the beginning that, yes, it's a political process, but it needs to look at the social and economic factors. Now, two points I want to make on this particularly. We all need to understand that Iraq will never be the same as it was before the fall of Mosul. And there is no way that the country can return to that status quo which was before the fall of Mosul. Yeah. So a new balance will need to emerge. And part of addressing that balance will need to come from how you deal with the constitution. I come from a transition country. Bulgaria, after the end of communism, put together a constitution very quickly, and now, 20 years later, we're still struggling with problems that this constitution presents. Any transition constitution which you write in a way that protects you from the past.
Definitely.
From the history, to make sure that what happened in the past doesn't happen again. But now, 10 years later, you see different challenges, challenges which you could not have imagined 10 years ago. In Iraq, you need to also look at the unfinished constitutional agenda. The federal court law would be a perfect starting point. You need to look at the Federation Council and all the various revenue sharing and other legislation. But you also need to look at the constitution itself. What state do you need to want to have? Yes. And I think if people in Iraq would focus on this long enough and hard enough, they will understand that they can have an Iraqi identity which allows you to be Shia and Sunni and Kurdish and Yazidi and whatnot, and still have loyalty to the state of Iraq. And rebuilding that loyalty is extremely important. And that does not mean that you would not have, you know, the legitimate aspirations that the Kurdish people, for example, have, or their their wish for more autonomy, etc., etc. But you can still be Iraqi and be some whatever ethnic or religious group you belong to.
Yes.
I have one more question, and I'm going to open it up to the floor so we can get a couple of questions in before you leave and get everyone else to respond as well. And that is the regional role. You mentioned it already. I mean, many would say that the region has to be dealt with and it has to build a new vision. And in Iraq, we have, of course, seen signs of regional cooperation here, and including the role of Iran within that regional situation. How, going forward, do you see that regional role being made even more constructive, more productive? Particularly here, I'd ask you to speak to the role of Iran, and also the role of the United States in that regard.
Well, let me try and separate that into two parts. One is the regional role as far as the challenge of ISIL is concerned, because ISIL-Daesh presents a challenge to everybody in the region, and there needs to be cooperation in dealing with that. So I leave that aside for a minute. But as far as Iraq is concerned, I think a lot of Iraq's neighbors, particularly in the Gulf, need also to understand that this is a new country, that this is a different country. And part of the problems of the relationship between Iraq and its Gulf neighbors is because of this disengagement which happened over the last few years between the Gulf and Iraq. And it has various reasons, political, others. But rebuilding that relationship will be extremely important. Obviously, Iran, as Iraq's immediate neighbor to the east, always will play an important role in this part of the world. However, that role does not need to be a controversial one. On the contrary, I think today you will see increasingly that Iran has a growing interest in stability in Iraq. And that stability cannot come, and this is a clear realization by everybody, cannot come if one group dominates over another group. It can only come if there's a balance between the different groups and if there's the inclusive approach that we've all been talking about. Any other option would bring more terrorism, more conflict, more problems, and these problems would obviously reflect beyond the borders of Iraq. Secondly, you need to understand that, you know, Syria must always be in the back of everyone's mind. You know, we may be talking about Iraq, but there's a great big pink elephant in the middle of the room, and that is Syria. And how we deal with the problem of Syria, and hence the problem of Daesh in Syria, is a separate discussion. But that also needs to be addressed, because until when borders are being challenged, when groups stand up and say, well, I disregard this border, I disregard the international border between Iraq and Syria, everybody in the Middle East, including Iraq's neighbors, must look very carefully, because this problem can quickly spread and affect them. Therefore, you know, stability in Iraq, agreement between the various components, a strong state, you know, a state that is strong and is accountable and is democratic, is actually in the interest of all its neighbors. And this is one issue which I think slowly people are coming to realize.
Very good. I will leave that question for both of you as we take some other questions as well. But I do want to see if open up the floor and see if people would like to ask some questions. The SRSG in particular has about 15 minutes or so, so I'd like to get some questions in. If you could clearly state your name and any affiliation, that would be great. Sir.
Yeah, my name is Karam. I had two questions. The first question is, don't you think that the UN should refer the matter of arming non-state actors to the International Criminal Court? Because don't you think that from the Libya experience, from the Syria experience, the arming non-state actors have always caused conflicts? My second question is, don't you think that the U.S. as a former occupier of Iraq should have the responsibility of facing Daesh on the ground, not just by airstrikes? Thank you.
Okay. Do I see a hand up there somewhere? Alexander?
Justin Alexander, a former UNAMI employee. What things could Haider Abadi do in the first few weeks of his government that could restore trust from the Sunni and Kurdish communities in the government and galvanize the fight against Daesh?
Thank you. I'll take a lady, please. It's just a microphone. Name and affiliation.
Sahar Attar from Qatar Radio.
Sahar Attar from Qatar Union. Radio.
Coalition against Daesh. And how do you see it evolving? Is it a question of months, of years?
Okay. I'll take the gentleman behind the lady, and then I'll come to the lady. Please.
Khaled Diab.
Yes, Qatarati Crescent. The question is related to arming Kurdish. What do you think the international community has to offer for Turkey to reduce their concern over arming PKK? Thank you.
Okay, I will come for another round with Dr. Zakir and others in a minute. Let's quickly go through the study with you, Nikolai.
Thank you for these questions. Very quickly on the first question on the role of the UN in preventing the funding and the arming of non-state actors. This is new territory for the UN, if you wish. It is emerging as we speak because this is a new problem that needs to be tackled now. And if you see over the last few weeks, a new resolution was adopted by the Security Council under Chapter 7 specifically on ISIL. And it has some very good text which I think points in the direction in which the international community is moving. Strengthening the sanctions, looking at all the various components that need to be put in place to prevent the funding, the arming, the access of terrorist groups to resources. Now, that's the first step. Now, the second step should come within a couple of weeks, I believe, when the Security Council will be considering another resolution on foreign fighters and on the responsibility of states to prevent their nationals and to participate as fighters in other conflicts. The interesting thing about these two resolutions is that they are both under Chapter 7. And this is quite an interesting point because they cross national borders. They actually address an issue which you cannot pinpoint to one country, as you said yourself. And I think they point the direction in which the international community will be moving. So there will be responsibilities taken on by states to prevent activities that may arm terrorist groups or provide them with resources, including people. On your second question, I think it's really a judgment of what is most effective in the situation today. And really, yes, you need boots on the ground to resolve the problem of Daesh in Iraq, but it better be Iraqi boots on the ground in their own country, well-trained, obviously well-equipped, perhaps supported from the air if they need to be supported by the Americans and the international community itself. And if the Iraqis themselves feel that more is needed, it should be for them to ask him to decide whether that is needed. And I think that's sort of the proper way of looking at it. Obviously, these troops, in some occasions, they should be Iraqi army troops, but quite often you will find that actually they don't need to be boots, but they need to be policemen. And they need to be local security forces protecting their communities. So that's, I think that's the direction. What can Prime Minister Abadi do? Many things, but there are quite a few things which perhaps would be a good start. And one would be really living up to the commitment to have a defense and interior minister within a week, and it seems that that will be possible. Secondly, to square away very quickly the problems with Iraqi Kurdistan that have been piled up for more than half a year now, and he's made obviously some commitments to that can be useful. A third and an important step would be a decision to stop shelling, for the Iraqi security forces to stop shelling cities, including Fallujah and other places where you can move forward more effectively in other ways. So obviously there are a number of these issues that can be done rather quickly. And he has, in his speech, openly spoken about the need to reach out to the region and to talk to the neighbors of Iraq in all directions in order to find support. So that's these are some ideas. What can one expect from the coalition? I wouldn't actually speak about one coalition. I would actually look at this as sort of multi-layered coalitions, because obviously, if you are, if some countries will look at how they can provide security-related support to Iraq, but then there's a different constellation of countries that need to work together to prevent financing getting to terrorist organizations and groups. Then there's a third constellation that can address the sort of the propaganda that ISIL is coming up with and challenge that. And perhaps there's a constellation to look at the problem of foreign fighters, because many of them, they come from the region, but some of them come from Europe, from elsewhere. Different measures. So I wouldn't think of it as one sort of permanent coalition. It would be different coalitions that can do different things. And obviously for the United Nations, there's a great role in this to play. And as far as Iraq, I think the United Nations can be very helpful in reaching out to the Sunni communities within Iraq, reestablishing that connection there, which would be also helful, but also in working with the region as well. And lastly, on the question of Turkey and the PKK, I think Turkey has very legitimate concerns about arms reaching the PKK. And if you look carefully at how the decision-making process of providing military support to Iraq has worked over the last few weeks, you will see that there's a great insistence on coordination, not just between those countries that are supporting the Peshmerga now with weapons and others, but to make sure that support is provided with the consent of Baghdad and the Iraqi government. And this is a very important sort of safety mechanism in this process. In the medium run, I think what would be very important is for the international community to focus not just on providing, but to focus more in the security field on providing training, capacity building of the forces, strengthening the institutions so that they are capable on their own to handle handle the problem of Daesh.
Thank you. Excuse please.
Me. Yes. As an Iraqi,
yes, please.
I just want to ask my colleague, Miladino, although it's unusual, forgive me, but as an Iraqi present here in this hall, we met a lot, and we worked together to help the immigrants, internally displaced people in Iraq, especially in Erbil. The situation there is really vague, and the aids came from people in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf, with many thanks to their brotherhood with us, but it still needs to be clarified. And I tried to send a message with your excellency to the situation, and I'm ready to meet there in Erbil to discuss the issue more. Thank you.
Thank you. And let me, please, Louis. And yeah. You can ask a question too, if you like.
Yeah, just a couple of points I would like to add to the list that mentioned by Basim Mladenov. The regional countries can do a lot, specifically a country like Turkey. At the moment, the southern corridor of Turkey is the gateway of foreign jihadists traveling into Syria and Iraq. This is the only gateway, regardless of all the nationalities. It's been monitored that since the 10th of June, the number of fighters, jihadists, affiliated with ISIS, has increased from 10,000 to triple, to nearly 30,000. 60% of those are of foreign fighters. 10% of the total, at nearly 3,000, anything between 2,500 to 3,000, are people with European passports. And just to show the significance, the serious threat that poses into not only to Iraq and Syria, but having a potential threat to Europe for the national securities of these countries when those sleeper cells travel back. Those numbers have increased mainly because, number one, there is no serious clampdown on these inflow of those jihadists into Iraq and Syria. Number two, nobody has done anything to the black economy, controlled and fueled by smuggled oil from northern Iraq, northern west of Iraq, but predominantly from northeast Syria, which is fetching around $3 million plus US dollars from the smuggled oil. This has created some sort of self-sufficiency to this transnational group to finance itself without even needing to, whether it's individual entities or state actors in the region. And this is the dangerous part of it. And in fact, maybe one positive things that came out of ISIS in Iraq, it has unified everyone to be scared of the future. There was a saying, by the way, in 2003 that the Shia are afraid of the past, the Sunni afraid of the future, and the Kurds are afraid of both. Now they are afraid of the future, all of them. So this really need to be done by paying attention by the international coalition, and the UN could really enforce UN Security Council Resolution 2170 and to really have every single state, entity, individuals accountable on these practices.
Great. Thank you very much. I'll take two quick questions before Nikolai leaves. Dr. Zakaria. It's good.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My question to Mr. Ala.
Me?
Yes.
Yes, welcome.
Please, I want to know if what is happening in Iraq, a peaceful revolution against sectarian government, which turned to armed revolution to take their rights, or this is aggression from Daesh state against the state of Iraq. This is one. The second, you said that Daesh is paying $2,000 for each fighter there. I think estimations say that there are about 65,000. Who financed Daesh? Who armed Daesh? And if you find a job for me there, please, can you reserve it for me? Thank you.
I don't think you want to say that publicly. Do we have any more questions for the SRSG? Okay, sir, at the back. At the back. If you could stand up, please. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Latif. As you have mentioned, the neighbors of Iraq has independent desires, but if they stand together and sit, then will it help? Because especially the Middle East countries and the neighbors of Iraq, if they sit together, will it help a resolution for Iraq's today's situation? Because why I'm asking this question is there any possibility for keeping U.S., the father of the destruction of Iraq, from this issue? Because they are planning for a military exercise now. So is there any way we can ask U.S. to be away from this situation, from Iraq's current situation? And is there any way we can completely avoid U.S. getting into this resolution of Iraq's problem? So what I'm asking is, neighboring countries of Iraq and the Middle East can lead to any resolution for this situation? That is one question. Then second question is, do you have any, is there anyone have any kind of communication or contact with this IAS, ISIS or whatever, so that we can just guide them and track them into the right track instead of getting into the massacre and, you know, brutality what they are doing today? And is there any provision we can bring them into the development of Iraq, maybe bringing them into the military, or I don't know.
Thank you. Yes, can we talk them into stopping at least chopping people's heads off? Please, and anything else you'd like to say in wrapping up?
I think really the decision of what role should or could the United States play in supporting Iraq in its struggle against this problem should be left to the Iraqi government and its parliament, yeah, and its people.
It's an Iraqi decision.
It should be an Iraqi decision. And if they feel that they need training, they should get that training from their allies. If they feel that they need air support, they should get that air support from their allies. You know, with all of its faults, problems, difficulties, the political process in Iraq, everything, Iraq has an unmatched capacity to get to the brink, to look into the abyss of disaster, to put one foot out and then step back. And this country has done this quite a few times. So I'm hopeful that, you know, despite all of the hardships, despite all of the challenges and the difficulties that we face on the ground, the fact that an election took place, a government is in place, and that it includes practically everybody, a new president's in place, a new speaker of parliament's in place, a new agenda has been put forward, a new approach is emerging within the neighbors. All of this should give us hope that actually the problem can be resolved. And if the Iraqis feel that they need the support of their allies, they should ask for it, and they should obviously get it. On ISIL, please understand that ISIL is an irreconcilable problem. ISIL is like a cancer that breeds off the body of Iraq and Syria at this point, and it can spread further beyond. It needs to be treated, it needs to be contained, and it needs to be ultimately resolved, because otherwise it will continue to grow. ISIL's philosophy is very simple. It seeks to dismantle the Iraqi state. It seeks to destroy the institutions that exist. It seeks to insert itself wherever problems are. Communities, Shia and Sunni, disagree. It inserts itself in that disagreement. It attacks schools. Yes. Forces women to become suicide bombers in schools. This is a very, very serious challenge to the order, yes, of things. It wants to dismantle borders. So really, the people who we should be reaching out to are those who have tribes, other groups, who have different agendas, who don't necessarily agree with this radical agenda, and bringing these other groups into the political process, seeing what of their demands can be resolved through the constitution, where can dialogue happen? And thus isolate the problem in itself and seek how to resolve it. But this is really a task that has to be led in Iraq, within Iraq, but it does need wide international support, and again, the region and everyone beyond can provide a lot of assistance in making sure that issue is challenged effectively.
Thank you very much, Nikolai. I have to let you go, otherwise we'll have to keep all the other people who are travelling with you on that Qatar Airways flight from leaving as well. I want to thank you very much. I also want to acknowledge two old colleagues and friends, Marwan Ali, the political director of UNAMI, who is an old friend. We served together at the UN in Gaza and in Palestine. It's great to see you here. And Miroslav Zavirov, former representative of Bulgaria here, who's now with UNAMI as well. Thank you all for coming. We wish you
welcome.
Safe travel. I've got still Dr. Zakaria's question for Dr. Ala, and would anyone else like to make a comment or ask a question? The gentleman with the white hair in the back, and then the gentleman with the hat afterwards.
Thank you. Charlie Eastwood, I'm with the Qatari Joint Command and Staff College down in Al Wakra. Nobody's mentioned the Iraqi army to any substantial degree. Can I ask the obvious question, where are they and what contribution are they likely to be able to make, or what do they need in order to be able to make a substantial contribution to the IS problem? Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. And then the gentleman here.
I'm Ashraf Siddiqui, a journalist. I have a couple of friends, or known to me, some journalists, who have been very regular visiting that area of Iraq. And they have informed me a couple of months before, even last year, that this group is accumulating the weapons. They are having large gatherings of the people. And they told me that they have informed even to their friends in UK, in America, and no action was taken. These powers knew that this group is developing. But why no action was taken before?
Thank you. Do we have anyone else? Okay. Dr.
Yes. Alex. As regards Dr. Zakaria, two lovely questions to me. How it developed that it began as peaceful demonstrating and people going out under democracy to express their concerns without answers, and later on it developed to what we ended now. Yes, you are describing the real events. It began as demonstrations. It began as political concerns, because I was part of it. No answer. On the contrary, insisting on not answering. Whether it is part of external agenda, or it's a reaction, or it's whatever the cause, I don't know. But it happened. Later on, it developed with all these circumstances, marginalization, no services, no answering to any concern, no release of detainees, etc. Daesh and the terrorist ideology is nearby the region. We had just, I told you at the beginning of my talk, we had just spent great efforts to kick out Al-Qaeda from Iraq several years ago. But that doesn't mean we could, kick them 100%. Still, some sleeping cells was the nuclei for new development of Daesh. They entered inside the demonstrations. And me personally, and a lot of other politicians, told the decision makers in Baghdad, the top decision makers, without mentioning names, and threatened them. Look, if you leave this situation, it will be as such. This is an equation, especially in Iraq. Nobody listened. So I took a trip to Washington, to State Department, and to explain in details all what is going on the ground at that time. It was at the beginning, and I told them, the people responsible on Iraqi desk there, look, I am an Iraqi, simple citizen, coming here, telling you there will be sequence of events, 1, 2, 3, 4. The same people, after a year, they visited Baghdad, and they said, they met me, and they invited me to attend a lecture. They said, look, you were right. I said, it's too late. So that's the answer. It's the people. Now, the concern is not the terrorist. The terrorist should be kicked out. The concern is the people living under those terrorists, under the pressure. Millions of people. The immigrants, the internally displaced, now constitutes about 1.5 million. But yet there are other millions under the governance of them. So this is the concern. So I'm telling you, if you are satisfied with this answer, I come to the second question, if you like to have a salary from IS. Okay, I tell you, because I am living in a borderline area, that's Erbil, near the terrorists. You heard about, Daesh attacking the nearby terrorists, territories nearby Erbil. And I meet daily people coming, escaping from Daesh. They are coming having no money, no houses, and no facilities, and they are living on streets. And I told Mladenov, you heard me, because we are working there together to give humanitarian aids to them, and there is some, laziness anyhow. He will tackle. I just warned him about that. But this is the important issue. This situation led the young people going to Daesh for living issue, for taking salaries. The sources of Daesh, they took all the national banks in the provinces. They are controlling sometimes the Beji refinery in Beji, in the middle of Iraq, in Salah ad-Din, and they are taking taxes. They have Abrams tanks. I don't know how much. They have helicopters. So they have budget, and you have to know. It's not just news concerns and the media saying so. I'm coming from the ground. And, the international community really realizing that, and sometimes they are searching a way, as one of our friends said, a way to discuss with them. So this is the situation, my friend. And I am maybe from the total people here, I'm coming from the land, and I'm telling you exact situation. Thank you.
Where is the Iraqi army, just quickly, this?
Yes, Iraqi army, I have answered.
Please.
Me also?
Please. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Well, all of the questions are asked. We're going to start summing up. So,
okay.
Please,
yeah. The question about the Iraqi army. The last 3 months, I spent my time from the morning until evening meeting, my friend, members of previous Iraqi army, all high-ranked officers, generals, field marshals, and they are escaping from being killed by Daesh. So they want to fight. They say, we're ready, and we can recruit our, brigades, all these sectors of the army, and we need support, we need help, and we need to be dealt honestly, because the previous trial, And we were engaged in deeply, where we went to Washington, we met President Bush, and we asked help to get rid of the terrorism occurred 2006, 2007, 2008, you know. And there was a positive reply, and General Petraeus came to Iraq, and we worked together. But the people, those people, when they worked honestly, they fighted the Qaeda, they were rewarded badly. And this is the question. So they want guarantees to be members of the coming guards or the coming Iraqi army to work, and they are ready to sacrifice themselves because they will be already killed by Daesh. Why? They are having this support. But this is a strong but. The history of the previous Iraqi army in the Middle East is not good. And we know that. And many of the neighboring countries' leaders, and even some leaders inside Iraq, they are against this idea. Because they are saying most of those officers are Ba'athists, and they have bad history in the previous army. I tell you from this point, the Iraqi army, it wasn't Saddam's army. It was Iraqi army. And maybe all or most of the pro-Saddam officers went out. Even they are killed or disappeared or escaped. Because the pro-Saddam, this is the situation of them. The people left living in the provinces who ISIS came to kick them out, they are the people who want to be Iraqis, who want to be remaining in their provinces, remaining on their lands, loyal to Iraq. And they are present. If you want me to bring some groups to meet them, I'll be ready. If we can help with Brookings help, a sort of conference to bring some of them to talk worldwide, we are ready. Me and Dr. Riyad Allawi and other colleagues, we are supporting them politically, and we are working to cook, not a food, but to cook a well-prepared, action for including them, for controlling them on the new basis after 10th of June, as Mladenov said. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and definitely we will continue our discussion to see how we can be
helped. Well, it's an invitation to Brookings to do this, and we are ready to.
On live television.
Oh, yes, so now we can hold live. We should work live all the time.
Thank you. Lou, I'll give you the last word, please. Please address some of the questions that have been
asked. Well, very much I would like to address the couple of questions about the alert of ISIS entering Iraq as well as the army issue. I must say, I do commend the statement of Dr. Abadi when he said pre-assuming sworn in as Prime Minister in his first press conference when he said, we are not prepared to send people from the south to the front in the north or to send army, whatever. And within the context that he said that I would like to see the Mosul people defending Mosul, Anbar people defending Anbar, Tikrit people defending. And this is and the army will be playing a supportive role as when it needs to be. And this should be the case, because the army is for should defend the border and should defend from external threat, while the internal securities need to be defended by the local police, by the intelligence services, etc. However, Iraq is under attack from most of those ISIS are external threats. So the involvement of the army is legitimate, and that's why we could see the Iraq security, Iraq special forces, the Firqa al-Dhahabiyya, it's known.
Yes.
It's very much involved as opposed to the traditional tanks and so on, the army artilleries. So we have these special forces cooperating and working side by side with the Kurdish Peshmerga, and they've already established a joint operation room in Erbil, and cooperating together to make some advances. They've made some good successful advances, including the takeover of Mosul. Just imagine the what would have happened had happened to the southern to the downstream of all these provinces if that would to be blown up or whatever. They took over the fields of Ain Zala or Batma these advances added value and moral successes to the whole of the nation. Again, for the future, Iraq should build an army and national security on national doctrine, as opposed to how many Sunni or Shia or Kurds or whatever. The national once we have a national army, this could be a step forward to restoring the national identity. The other thing about the ISIS, in terms of like the why nobody why no one did anything about ISIS, knowing that they are coming. Well, ISIS entry to Iraq was very much, or all of the, let me address them as Al-Qaeda splinter groups, entry to Iraq was very much an inevitable entry. It was a result of the Syrian conflict. If you would just go a small search on the YouTube and look into, for example, the various peaceful demonstration since January 2013. Let's be specific. Let's not go from the very first 2 months or so. But there were a lot of sectarian groups promoting a very aggressive language and parading Al-Qaeda flags, then becoming ISIS flag and so on. So the host was very much there to welcome such an entry, and no army on earth would have prevented such entry. Only the local would have done something. And just to give you an example, a small district is called Amirli. The population around 15,000 people. It was under siege for 10 weeks. 10 weeks. Left with no ammunition, women and children. Because there is no host there, majority Turkmen, they defended that district. Al-Qaeda, the insurgencies and ISIS failed to penetrate that village with all their power, under 10 weeks. So when you have such momentum to defend a local territory, if we can replicate that sense of responsibility to other provinces, there will be no ISIS and no Qaeda and no penetration. So to conclude, I think I would refute the claim of many pessimists that no elections, no cabinet, nothing. I think we've seen everything on track. We had an election on time. We had all the key positions being filled on time. We had a cabinet established on time within less than 5 months. This is a record. And we have a more of an inclusive cabinet, inclusive administration. I don't like to prejudge the performance of this cabinet is yet to be tested, and we should only look forward for a more accountable administration to deliver a success story to Iraq in cooperation, not only with the local content of Iraq, but with the neighboring country to bring Iraq back as part of the regional powers of the Arabian Peninsula.
Thank you very much. It's a good way to end. In just briefly summing up, Nikolai talked about the efforts of ISIL to dismantle the Iraqi state. You as Iraqis know, of course, that Iraqis have been contributing to that even before ISIL. Yes. Now, post-Mosul, maybe this is the time with the new government and what Iraq, but with the challenges it faces, the challenge is very much with Iraqis, to see how they can rebuild that state and that identity that you talk about. Also, I guess, for the regional and international community, the question is, how do you, and for the United States in particular, how do you build a strategy which is initially talking about a surgical action against ISIL, but becomes more comprehensive in contributing to assisting Iraqis in rebuilding that state. And maybe in that, again to leave on a more optimistic note, maybe there are the makings of a regional political deal as well, which could perhaps even include Iran in that context, and which is also a shining light of an example to how you can put Syria back together again, as well as the wider region. Let me thank you very much, Dr. Allah, for making the trip, and of course to you, Louis, and thank you for coming. At the back, we have some sweets so that you can add some calories to your diet. But for now, let us thank you to our esteemed guests. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.